Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. Through this platform, we highlight the unique stories of people making a difference as marketers, entrepreneurs, and social impact advocates, or people who are all of the above.
Before we get into this week's episode, we want to make our podcast an engaging story for you. This means we want your feedback. Click the link in our show notes to answer some questions about your listening experience.
On this week's show, we chat with Jess Weimer, who leads global revenue marketing and is the global pipe gen officer at Confluent. We used her extensive expertise to cover everything from navigating your marketing at a hypergrowth company to the crucial nature of employee resource groups, where she serves as an executive sponsor.
We had a great conversation with Jess. She's a modern demand-to-revenue marketing executive with proven achievement in building and scaling global, data-driven, operationally savvy, integrated demand strategies directly resulting in pipeline attainment. She has deep expertise in orchestrating marketing to sales plays, spanning digital field strategies in commercial through enterprise accounts to create pipeline velocity. Jess is extremely passionate about inspiring and mentoring teams across the globe and heavily invests in team growth and scale. Jess is most proud of the fact that she leads with empathy while innovating with grit. Prior to Confluent, Jess served as Vice President of Global Revenue Marketing at Financial Force, bringing to life their first ABX strategy. She also held leadership positions at Adobe, ServiceNow, and 8x8. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Jess Weimer. Hi, Jess. Thank you for being on Long Story Short.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for having me.
Yeah, so I want to start with where you are today. And you have an interesting challenge in that Confluent is experiencing hyper growth, but you're really trying to build that plane while it's flying. And so just want to get a sense from you in terms of what that experience has been like.
Yeah, this experience has been like no other rocket ship that I've been on. You know, Confluent is not even 7 years old and has accomplished so much over the last 7 years. In terms of incredible year-over-year growth, in terms of how the company has built, you know, its different teams and functions, you know, operating as if it's a 20-year-old company, you know, in terms of building the plane while we fly it. The one thing that wasn't in place last year, which is one of the many reasons that I was drawn to joining Confluent, was there wasn't a campaign strategy or a campaign focus. And so, you know, I thought to myself, how is this company so successful, but, you know, doesn't have that fundamental campaigns motion already running? And the reality is, you know, you can build a rocket ship without it, but how you build for scale is where this comes into play. And so the whole concept of ABM, you know, account-based orchestration, as I like to call it, that's something that drew me to this opportunity, amongst other things, like the people and, you know, just being able to amplify the success that they've already built. And so in terms of the actual account-based orchestration, you know, campaigns is the foundation of that, right? You can't really do company-wide account-based marketing if you don't have your campaigns motion solidified. We're at an inflection point where we've built a lot. There's tons of pockets of greatness. And now we're building for scale, which includes augmenting our approaches across dimensions in marketing. And, you know, what I've learned or been reminded of is that even rocket ships need integrated marketing. And so that's, you know, where we are today and super excited about all that means in terms of how we're augmenting to build for scale.
Yeah, I love that quote. I think that's so important. And again, that's why I wanted to sort of start by framing, it wouldn't necessarily seem to be a challenge to say you're in hyper growth mode. You know, how bad could that be? But I think to your point that at some point that will have sort of a natural leveling off period. And really the way to then continue and to make sure that rocket ship keeps flying at the speed it's flying is to make sure that you have those processes and the structures in place and that the marketing engine is really built to kind of fully. So once that rocket fuel kind of runs out, now you have the engines going at full speed.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where you start to take a look at, and this is where we are today, is, you know, the different personas. Like enterprise buying committee is not just one person. It's not just one tactic. And so there's different things like moving away from looking at tactics in isolation, understanding the actual journey of the different personas. And what we're doing right now is we're molding together the bottoms up and tops down motion. And there's a lot of learning that has to happen with that. But here's the tricky part is if you're introducing a new motion on top of something that you've already done that is so successful, you don't have the data or the history to show you which direction to take that new motion in. And that's an interesting part. Like, how do you really become a data-driven marketing engine when you don't have that baseline data to start with? You have to build it. You have to establish it. And so that's also part of what, you know, our journey is consisting of right now.
Yeah. And just, you know, before we dig into data, because we'll get there in a second, I'm just curious in general, because, you know, we sort of started and you mentioned ABM, account-based marketing, but I know that that's not necessarily the term you use. So I'm just curious again, like why specifically you've chosen to refer to it as account-based orchestration?
Yeah. Account-based orchestration, I think, is a better label for the heavy lift across multiple teams that is required to do this successfully. Account-based marketing, you know, it implies that it's on one person or one function. So for example, as part of my revenue marketing organization, I have a campaigns team. They can't single-handedly orchestrate an end-to-end account-based motion. They are definitely the quarterback and that central nervous system that brings the different functions together. But you need alignment from, you know, sales strategy. Who are we actually going after? Product marketing, who are those target personas and what are the key messages that they care about? The activation channels, if you take everything from digital, always on, paid, owned, earned, field marketing, when we get to the middle of the funnel, what are those deal acceleration events? How do trade shows and other marketing activation channels play a part? So bringing that all together. And then last but not least is sales. Our number one customer is sales. Do these campaigns resonate? Are these the messages that you're hearing on the field? Can you absorb these campaigns? Can you take these kits and everything that we're going to put together and build that muscle memory to help deliver these messages to the prospects that you're speaking with as well? So it's not just on a marketing person or a function within marketing. It's true orchestration, and the handholding between all the different functions has to be crisp.
Yeah. And I think the thing that struck me, you know, when I saw that that's the term you use, is really that account-based marketing, and you know, there's been a lot of research and studies that have shown that it really hasn't fulfilled the promise, bigger picture, that people might have thought it would. And if you think about it, the term account-based marketing sounds like you're laying on that on the marketing team, when to your point, it is, by definition, needs to be an integrated approach across the entire organization.
Exactly. If your sellers are not bought in on even the who, like, that's a showstopper right there. If you are doing account-based activities towards accounts that don't even match up with what your sellers are aligned to in terms of who their focused accounts are, then you're already mismatched.
Yeah. So I want to come back to data. That's a topic that I always personally love talking about. And I really love what you said around that, you know, frankly, everyone wants to be a data-driven organization, but you need to have the data and the history to start somewhere. And so I'm interested too, just in terms of that, we talk a lot about balancing the art and science within marketing, science being data, certainly. And so I'm just curious how you go about navigating sort of having, you know, let's say an attribution model, but understanding that not all of the value of what marketing is doing can really be captured neatly into a single number.
This is a big challenge that I think exists amongst many organizations. Number one is there is no perfect attribution model. And what makes it harder is when you are doing a net new motion, not having the historical data, and then having an attribution model where you know there is work to be done on it, how do you set yourself up for success? So the way I approach this is you have to build, you have to pilot, you have to measure, and then iterate and establish that foundational data for what is needed to learn and scale. Where people can get hung up is that word measure. Because again, everyone has something to say about their attribution model, no matter what organization you work with, right? Like, you can pick it apart. You can actually make data say whatever you want it to say if you tried hard enough. And so when, you know, you're in a situation like I am where you have two motions going, you have our bottoms up that we've had, you know, historically for the last almost 7 years. And we have this new motion going tops down without historical data, but we're trying to measure what we're doing. And if it's not looking right or something seems off, how do you keep that from stopping you from moving it forward, right? How do you not let it get in the way? And that's where, you know, you have to marry the science and art together, right? Like, it's not just about the numbers. So for example, if you have a net new motion of going after executives in an enterprise sales cycle. We all know that this is not a commodity product. They're not going to convert into an opportunity right away. Where they take part in the conversation is different than, you know, a practitioner who is the one who is touching and feeling the product, right? So you have to marry in that art and say, well, I can't compare the numbers that I'm seeing for this new motion to what we've done in the past, because it's not apples to apples. And if you get hung up on the measurement or what the numbers are saying initially, you're not going to be able to learn or iterate. You're gonna stop yourself right there. And so that's the tricky part, I think, as marketers, is when you're going after a full enterprise buying committee, not each persona behaves the same. Where they come into the sales cycle is different, right? Not everyone is that first stop and that first conversation. And so data is super important, but you can't automatically become a data-driven company until you've established the foundational journeys and give yourself something to learn from.
Yeah, and I think just to summarize, to let it be a guide, let it be directional, but don't make every single decision based on the exact numbers. Because again, no matter what model you put in place, no matter how complex it is, there is no quote unquote right model.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
I want to take a step backwards, actually, now that we've covered what your world looks like today. And I want to just get from you, and would love to hear your perspective on what led to you coming to Confluent and the challenge that you put on yourself to do that.
Yeah, that's a great story. You know, I look back a year ago. I'm just coming up on my year here at Confluent. So I was at a different organization heading up global revenue marketing, everything from, you know, digital to field, strategic events, all the campaigns. And I had just been there for over a year when Confluent first reached out. And I had done a lot in that year, you know, inherited a team, scaled out the team. I also had marketing operations, which was, you know, an anemic part of the team at the time. So built that out, started building out the data and, you know, doing all sorts of fun things and accomplished a lot. And so when Confluent first approached me, I thought to myself, well, no, I'm not done yet. Like I have my 2.0 ahead of me at my prior company. I'm excited about what that will look like. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, I became an overnight homeschool crisis mom, you know, that really had to just figure that out without any heads up. I remember it March 13th. It was, your kids are coming home, come pick up their computers, figure out schoolwork and all of that. And so when Confluent approached me again, you know, I did take the conversations because it's Confluent. You know, when a hyper growth, successful company, you don't ignore the call. And I know some folks who were there who were happy. And the more I had those conversations, the more excited I got about how much opportunity there was for me to come in and put my, not just my fingerprints, but my handprints on things. And so I was excited about the people that I met, you know, not just in the marketing organization, but across the company. And with COVID hitting, you know, that also really put a stall on my plan to do a 2.0 at my prior employer, meaning, you know, everything is slowing down, push pipe, customers, prospects, you know, buying big solutions. Like we didn't know what was going to happen. And so I told myself I have two options. I have established myself at this current company. I could kind of sit back and focus on my kids, figure out how to be a teacher, get them through school and this, you know, unexpected thing that is happening in their lives. Or I could do that and also go put my handprints on something great. And so I chose the latter and I don't regret it. Definitely was a challenge because, you know, I had to learn everything from Seesaw to Google Classroom to applications I've never heard of and make sure my kids, you know, we're on their schedules and they're, you know, they're on two different schedules, but also needed to make a mark and make it quickly at Confluent. And so, and so that's what I chose and I don't regret it.
So speaking of making your mark outside of your daily duties with Confluent, you also serve as a mentor with Women in Revenue. And so I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about how mentorship works into your value set as a human being and a professional in the workplace.
Yeah. Thank you, Sophia. That's a great one I like to talk about as well. So in my career spanning the last two decades, there were not a lot of female leaders that I could aspire to learn from. I've been blessed enough to have a couple of strong female leaders that I've learned from, but there were not a lot. And a lot of the women that I've worked with over the last couple decades didn't necessarily have people to learn from, you know, a lot of women to learn from. And so I made it a point about a decade ago that I was going to try to be one of those people that can take younger women in their career, you know, show them the ropes, in the sense that my biggest successes have honestly come from my biggest failures, you know, and what I've learned. And so what type of prescription can I offer to younger women who are just starting out in their career? And so I started mentoring about a decade ago. It was with, you know, basically women that I worked with, younger women starting out in their career, people who were on my team, people who were on cross-functional teams. Conversations talking about career path, progression, you know, the common question I get is, how did you navigate your career? How did you get to where you are today, right? And I talk about different things that I've tried and what mattered to me and how I pursued it, some of the hardships that comes along with being a woman and being a woman leader. And then with Women in Revenue, a group that formed a couple of years ago, I know some of the founders of that group, they have a mentorship program. And so, of course, I signed up for that as well and got formally paired with someone we meet every week or so, talk about career progression, talk about everything, things that happen, you know, at work. How do you navigate this? Here's what I'm trying to do. You know, just whatever is top of mind for that person. And what really makes me feel like I'm making an impact is, you know, we get off these calls and she'll say, wow, once again, you've really helped me. Okay, I'm going to do that. And then, you know, when we check in the next week, we talk about how whatever that situation is went. And that's really, you know, it's formalized through Women in Revenue, but it really mirrors the conversations that I've had with mentees in the past as well. It's always about, okay, let's talk about what you want to do, but then let's talk about, did you do it? You know, and it's not about keeping them accountable. It's their, you know, mission. It's their desire. It's what they want to do, but it's someone that they know they can trust, that has no bias for what they're trying to do in their career. I'm just here to be an ear and also offer, you know, prescription based on my experience.
Yeah. And I think that's really important too. And something not everyone thinks about when considering mentorship is the value of not just, oh, I'm willing to offer you whatever kind of advice, but from someone who actually understands the experience and vantage point that person is coming to you asking for that advice. And that's why having women who are mentors or other intersectional identities who can identify with the experience of mentees or other people starting their careers is so essential. And it's not just a mentorship or advice that someone's feeling. So,
right. Exactly. And I made it a point, you know, almost a decade ago that, you know, I want to pay it forward. I didn't have the luxury of having a ton of women leaders around me that could, you know, inspire me and coach me and guide me. And so I thought, okay, how can I make it a point to do that for others? And it actually started very organically. Like I said, you know, younger women on my team as I was helping them as their manager, but, you know, also in terms of their broader, outside of their current job scope, as they would start to talk about, well, here's what I'm thinking. I'd like to explore this. I, you know, would that be okay? And I was always, don't worry about, you know, the job you have today. If you want to branch out and explore something else, I support that. I encourage that. I'm not going to box you in just because I selfishly value your impact in my team. And so, you know, that's one of the first mentees that I had. That's actually how the conversation originated, was because she was, you know, she wanted to explore other avenues of marketing versus kind of the revenue marketing demand gen pieces. And I definitely encourage and support that. And then still talk to her today, actually. She's actually grown significantly in her career in different avenues, which is great. But that's what we want to see. You know, we want to see females be empowered, that they can create their own destiny, they can follow through with it, but that they have people that they can talk to help them navigate, because it's not easy. You know, and everyone looks at, you know, how many men are on the leadership of a company. Oh, that means I can never get there. And we psych ourselves out with things like that. And I've learned how to just not even pay attention to that, because at the end of the day, you control your own destiny.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I mean, again, the flip side of that is we also have to be working towards creating workspaces that enable women and other people of minority identities to actually achieve that destiny that they're setting out to. And so I think it's really important that I also want to call out, you serve as an executive sponsor for ERG within Confluent. And actually, I was reading just yesterday about how having executive sponsors for employee resource groups are one of the easiest ways and most important ways to effectively get company DEI initiatives actually moving and get the ball rolling beyond just existing in the silo of that group. But it's something that so many companies don't do. So I want to commend you and Confluent for having that. And I would like to touch upon why that's so important and how you are involved in that work within Confluent.
Yeah, that's another thing that drew me to Confluent. There are some amazing women that head up our whole ERG function. I believe it started around the time that I joined Confluent a year ago in terms of, you know, establishing the different ERGs. You know, we have one for women. You know, we have our Black Fluent, we have our Queer Fluent, we have our Conmingos, which is our Latinx, you know, ACON for Asians at Confluent. You know, all of these ERGs were established, and I raised my hand. I couldn't raise my hand fast enough. I said, put me anywhere, put me in, coach, because with what is going on in this world and what was going on in the world last year, you know, in the wake of George Floyd and everything that happened, I had a talk with myself. You know, I said, yes, I've got a lot going on. I'm homeschooling 2 kids and I don't really know how to do that. I've started a new job, but the real world is just becoming a much scarier place. And as a mother, you know, I don't want my children living in a world like this. Like they know, they're so young, but they're not too young where they don't know what happened last year. You know, they're learning about it in school, which I actually appreciate. But I told myself, I need to do something. I need to do something outside of, you know, just my day job. And I need to figure out how to be a part of the solution. And so it's a really interesting twist for me because I'm a first generation, you know, born in America. My parents migrated here from India, and I don't talk about that often because I actually grew up concluding that those are things that are better left unspoken about in the work world, just to avoid judgment, you know, and some of the harsh realities of racism that I witnessed or experienced growing up. And so to that end, you know, I've always lived my life thinking I'm good. There's nothing for me to do because I'm not racist. In fact, I've experienced racism. What I've learned over this last year and a half is that not being racist is simply not good enough. And so part of why I asked to, you know, or, you know, when they asked for volunteers to lead or sponsor the ERG groups, I raised my hand because I want to help any group, whichever one they put me on. I want to tell me what I need to do. How can I help? Whether it's leverage my network to do, you know, community events, whether it's, you know, speaking about things, you know, for example, we have career progression tracks coming up, all of that. That's why I intentionally signed up for that. How can I help? But what I've also benefited from is attending the different sessions of the various ERG groups. So not even the one that I am an exec sponsor of. And that is where I have learned the most. You know, I've learned, you know, what it means to be anti-racist and to embrace that there are different pains and challenges that I need to acknowledge and empathize with across other cultures and groups in order to truly be an ally. So from being an executive sponsor for the ERG group that I was assigned to, plus participating and engaging in these other ERG, you know, sessions, it's just really enforcing to me, you know, what it means to be an ally. And one of the key learnings, you know, staying quiet is me not being part of the problem. And that's where I thought I was always good. How do I deliberately become part of a solution? And that's, you know, that there's a ton of work to do. There is no checkbox on that. There is no, I'm done, I did it. You know, this is going to be an always on ongoing thing. And it includes taking what I experienced through these ERGs and bringing it home with me. I know I work from home, so I'm literally already here, but in conversations with my kids, you know, with my husband, how we talk as a family, all of that.
You know, Jess, there are so many different points you made that I want to address. I have been sitting here nodding the entire time you've been speaking. I think the most important thing I first just want to highlight and respond to is, again, like at this point, if you are not actively part of a solution, then even if you're staying silent, that's part of the problem, right? And so I want to commend like taking that step. And again, the note that education is always, it's never, okay, I'm done. I'm educated now, right? It's an ongoing, even within your own groups that you identify with. I think a lot of times we think, oh, because I'm a part of this group, I identify as a woman, so I understand the experience of women, right? But even learning about groups that you are a part of, because women can still be sexist and, you know, people can still, even if you're a minority race, be racist. And so learning and understanding the intricacies of that and our biases is something that's never going to end. And so I think that's really important. And the power of conversation within different groups, which it sounds like is also an integral part of the employee resource groups separately and then cumulatively together. So that's what's top of mind, but there's probably about 500 other points that I was nodding along to that I'm now missing. But
yeah, what you've said, I actually want to underscore, because not just having these sessions and these ERG groups, I mean, the women who have built this up, I'm amazed. This is their full-time job, right? But what gives me chills is every time I go into one of these sessions, you know, we just had one on the Stop, you know, AAPI Hate, and brought everyone together. And what gives me chills is every single one of these that I go to, how many people speak up and speak. And so, you know, you mentioned the conversation piece. That is critical, because there are so many places in this world and even in certain companies where people don't feel like they can speak. So when I attend these things to listen and to educate myself, you know, not to sit here and talk about myself, but actually understand what these different people in these different groups have to say, I'm just so proud that they feel comfortable and that they know it's an inclusive space, and they know that we're all gathering here to have the conversation and to learn from each other and figure out how we can help. And so that has been the most rewarding part of my, you know, 20 plus career. It's just that experience alone, because I've never experienced that before.
Yeah, and I want to add, because I think this, I was vigorously nodding as well. And I think something you just said as well is that's so important, is diversity and inclusion are not the same thing, and one does not equal the other. And ultimately, all of the value and really where we need to be going as a society is getting to that inclusion and that inclusive place. And frankly, from our research, we've actually been able to prove a lot of that out. But frankly, that really is the key. That's the unlock. And I think it's so amazing to hear that there's now spaces that people do feel comfortable sharing.
And I just wish it was everywhere. It's sad that it's not the norm. Mm-hmm. Right. And that there's only certain pockets of places where people feel safe, that they can talk about their pains, what they're going through, and not feel that they're being judged in return, or that people are devaluing the pain or underestimating their pain.
I think, again, to your point, feeling sad about it and noting that that is the unfortunate reality is then, okay, so what can we do about it? And it sounds like you are taking your necessary steps. And I want to encourage everyone who sees that or feels that sense of sadness to then actually let's do something with it, right? I think that's the important thing, that a lot of people are like, well, this upsets me. And it's like, okay, let's use that as fuel, you know, and make some moves, get some tangible things going. And it's great that people started that employee resource group and these women have devoted their careers to developing that in your organization and making it then a space where that inclusion can actually come to fruition and it's not just a diverse workplace.
Right. And I would encourage anyone who takes part in their ERGs or, you know, sponsors, whatever role, keep doing it. There is no checkbox. And at times I'm always feeling or often feeling like I'm not doing enough. You know, we had our ERG sync with the different leaders and I said, I feel like I'm not doing enough. Like, we had our kickoff event for the ERG that I sponsor. I leveraged my network, brought in an amazing speaker who brought everyone to tears, you know, and I had a win. I thought, okay, I'm helping. But that's like one thing. And I'm always asking myself, like, what can I do more? And that's what's amazing about these ERG leaders, like the people who have defined the groups and they kind of, you know, bring all the sponsors together, is that they're almost helping to programatize it. Like, here are ways you can think about it. Here are things you can keep doing, right? So there's help. And we're not in this alone. And this is not a me thing at all. This is an us thing. And that's the reminder that I would put out there for anyone. I encourage you to get involved with your ERGs. You know, take time outside of your day job to understand the world is literally falling apart unless we do something different, all of us as a collective we. And, you know, don't feel intimidated that you're not doing enough, because just being a part of it and wanting to learn and wanting to seek to understand, you're halfway there, right? And you're making progress. And that's something that's really important to me. Again, as a mother, we all work for various reasons. My reasons used to be shoes and purses, but after having kids, it's everything is about them and their future. And what I've realized over this last year is this part of the world, like this reality, is something I don't want them to experience. I don't want them to be adults in this world that I'm living in right now.
So along the lines of creating a world that you want your kids to grow up in, one thing that I think is really interesting that we like to ask all of our guests is how they define success, right? And so what's going to make you, again, personally, professionally, however you want to take the question, you can answer both if they're different, but I'm really interested in what is going to make you feel successful in your life.
That's a great question. I think that's a really hard one, because as long as this world is operating the way it does, you know, with all these injustices and things that, you know, we can't control, whether they're near or far, I mean, I don't think any of us can feel like there's a success. However, for my children, for them to have empathy, for them to, instead of see no color, I want you to see the color. I want you to acknowledge the color. I want you to understand that there are pains, there are challenges, you know, and embrace people for just who they are, but be strong enough and wise enough to know that there are pains they're going through that you don't have to relate to, and understand what those are, and then be empathetic about it. And those are it sounds simple, but that can be really hard. You know, especially when you're a kid growing up, you're all about yourself, right? Like, it's where my friends, where my toys, where's my iPad? The world is so much more than that. And that's where I would feel relief when I consistently see signs that that's how they're operating. And, you know, we started the conversation at home last year. Again, it was a touchy time because their whole world's just, you know, crashed on them with COVID and being, you know, homeschooled. And then we're talking about George Floyd and trying to introduce, you know, the conversation of what's happening in the world. That's just a lot. It's a lot for young kids. But my husband and I discussed it and said, okay, we have to start saying something, because this is how the cycle repeats itself when people either just stay quiet or act like it's not a big deal.
I would argue that hope that you have for your kids is one that any adult can also take with them and apply. And I think thinking about ourselves goes far beyond kids and caring about their toys and what their friends are doing. I think adults care about their toys and what their friends are doing just as much.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that, Jess. That's really powerful. But before we let you go, I just want to ask, what resources would you want to recommend to the audience? Any books, blogs, podcasts, again, anything that you found to be beneficial?
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, I'm going to approach that question a little differently than I normally would have. You know, there are blogs, there are certain resources that I do gravitate towards, you know, in the spirit of revenue marketing and me personally always wanting to learn more and get more prescription. But just in the spirit of what we were just talking about, I'll answer that question by stating that the most beneficial resource that I think you have at this time is to turn to your team, listen to your team and across your broader teams. I think this past year has taught me that the status quo of leaning in as a leader is just not good enough. like everyone is going through something significantly more impactful to their life than ever before. Just like I talked about my kids' world, you know, all the kids homeschooling and what that did to them. Same with the people on our teams. And it's really difficult to find the time to connect with everyone on your team. You know, have about a 30-person team like across the globe. You can't do one-on-ones with everyone all day, every day. So, you know, depending on size, I am trying to figure out ways to be more deliberate about this, even if it's checking in with them through their manager. But connecting with your team and understanding what they're going through and making sure that they're okay, because it is impacting us all, you know, what has happened in this world. And just the status quo of leadership, I think, has changed too and needs to change as well.
I couldn't agree more. That's so well said. And where can people find you and connect with you on social media?
You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect. I'm happy to network. I love swapping stories, war stories, success stories, anything and everything. I am a firm believer that you can never stop learning. And so I'm here to learn. I'm here to learn from others, whether we're in the same industry or not. But I think we can always seek to understand other people's successes, other people's failures, and how we can learn and grow from them.
That's great. Well, Jess, thank you so much for being here. And most importantly, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff and Sophia. This was fun.
It was our pleasure. We really enjoyed talking to Jess. I love the point that even rocket ships need marketing. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. A big topic in our conversation with Jess was allyship. So I want to start our footnote section by defining it using a definition from a Harvard Business Review article, which of course will be linked for you all. They say, "We view allyship as a strategic mechanism used by individuals to become collaborators, accomplices, and co-conspirators who fight injustice and promote equity in the workplace through supportive personal relationships and public acts of sponsorship and advocacy. Allies drive systemic improvements to workplace policies, practices, and culture." There is a lot packed into this definition, which is why I like it so much. So first of all, I want to call out that they address three components of the relationship that allies should have with the groups that they are allies to. So collaborators, accomplices, and co-conspirators. Then through that relationship, you must fight injustices and promote equity, both in personal relationships and through public acts. They then break this down into how that can show face in a variety of systemic improvements from policies to practices to culture. Wow.
That's a lot. It's a mouthful. And what I'll say though, and I think the thing that connected with me immediately is the fact that, and it goes back to some of the stuff, Sophia, that you and I were literally talking about off air right before this, but it's important to have the personal nature of the individual relationships, but as well as sort of the public acts. And the reason that's so important is because I think one without the other makes it feel a little empty, right? Being there personally to help somebody that you are an ally to is great, right? That's a great place to start. But to help better that cause and to help be that co-conspirator and to help make the systemic change, there needs to be some sort of public act as part of that. But on the other hand, if there's a purely public act that doesn't actually resonate with any kind of personally intentional relationship, it feels really hollow.
Yeah. And I think that's why another thing that goes more individually with allyship is that portion of actually educating yourself. And I think once you're educated, it's not a conscious effort of, oh, well, I have to be doing this personal end and this public end. Because if you're aware of the different intricacies of injustice, then like hopefully you would be speaking up or discussing them with whomever, wherever you see it. And so I think that's another really important note. And when educating yourself as an ally, it's not enough also to just talk with or befriend a single person or read a single book from one perspective. I think what's really important is experiences are always going to be changing, which means you're going to constantly have to be re-educating yourself and learning new things. And everyone has a unique perspective. So generalizing stories of just a couple of colleagues or from one article that are then going to influence an entire position or stance that you have on something that you're calling allyship, that's just not going to cut it.
Yeah. And I think that's really important too. The fact that a whole lot of people will make up a particular group, but not every one person in that group is going to have the same experience towards that issue. So I think that's really crucial not to overgeneralize. But I think the other piece, again, is really that advocacy, to your point, that it's continuing to educate yourself, but it's continuing to find and identify opportunities within your life, within your experience, within the public domain, but in all of these places to see it as and name it as it happens. I think that's where some of these things, because whether we're talking about unconscious bias, whether we're talking about, you know, any one of those things, it's much more important to name it in the moment than it is to retroactively sort of identify again or make these kind of big grand public gestures, because until you change the little things, the big things will never actually be changed.
Yeah. And I think that even you can go before moments, right? And we can take these active steps to ensure maybe these moments don't happen, right? And so some ways that I actually want to call out as seemingly small, but actually have huge consequences to being an active ally is through sponsorship choices. So there's a lot of research that shows that sponsorship is critical to Black women specifically advancement in the workplace. So typically when leaders, more specifically white male leaders, are picking proteges or people to have these advancement conversations with, it's going to be people who look just like them. And so challenging yourself or considering who you typically gravitate towards in the workplace is a really, again, seemingly small, simple step, but actually has huge consequences to advancing women, specifically Black women in the workplace. And one other one that I think is really good to call out is when you're goal setting. So you should be having personal and company definitions. We talked about this in the episode of what success is actually going to look like for you. But when you're doing that, for example, outlining a target amount of the number of women that you're going to have on a board or for executive positions. That number also, again, needs to be broken down by how many women there will be of color or even of men on the board. There's different men. If there's people who don't identify with any gender binary, like making sure that we're intersectionally acknowledging all of these different identities and not just saying women, because we are bias. And if we say women, it will likely be only white women. So we need to make sure that we're, again, taking the steps to fight these biases before they show face in our decision making.
Yeah. And I think the 2 points I want to make on that, one that you mentioned around sponsorship, and the same really applies to hiring. I think the important part is the intentionality behind it, that it's easier for us as human beings to gravitate towards people that have more similar life experiences to us, which is going to end us up in the same type of circles that we are in ourselves. And so I think we all as a society understand the benefits of having a diverse set of ideas within organizations, but it's hard as human nature not to gravitate towards people that share your similar ideals, your life experiences. And so it's very important to be intentional about finding your way out of that. And the other thing is, then when it comes to defining those metrics of success, again, at a high level, I think that makes a ton of sense. But then again, there's more layers to it. So making sure that it's not just bringing in women or people of color to fill the low ranking positions and the low wage positions. It's really important that you think about representation and that, frankly, ultimately, it's about building the inclusive culture to welcome those diverse ideas and viewpoints into your culture, not just about checking a box and saying, we've met this threshold.
Yeah, I think even when you're bringing diversity into your C-suite or executive positions, you know, evaluating who's getting a seat at that table, right? Like, even if they're in a position, are you actually giving everyone a voice? Or you might hire a chief diversity officer, but like, are they actually doing anything? Are they able to communicate with the rest of the company? You know, it's not enough to just bring people into spaces. And so one thing that we talked about with this allyship at a more company level is employee resource groups. And so while we discussed in the episode some things to keep in mind for people or companies who have employee resource groups, I also want to acknowledge what to do if you potentially don't. So I have linked some additional articles that break down effective steps you can take for successfully setting up an ERG. But I think the crux of it that I want to call out here, which I think is valuable even if you already have one in place, is that first and foremost, you need to be clear on why you've selected certain communities in the first place and what the general purpose of these different groups is, right? If you don't have that, how is a successful group supposed to grow from there? And then again, committing to actually making these groups successful once you have that idea of success. So committing to funding and supporting employee resource groups, considering who's running those employee resource groups. Is your women's affinity group only run by white women? That's a problem. That's not going to represent all the concerns of all the women at the company. And thus, it's going to render it less effective than it could otherwise be. And then also considering if you're giving your employees the actual time to make this successful, right? Because this is taking time out of your employees' days, which they are hopefully willing to give, but you need to be willing to give them that time too. Otherwise, it will never be successful and you won't achieve that purpose that we initially talked about is so important to have.
Yeah, and the thing I just want to highlight there is that we hear this a lot. Is a lot of our listeners are probably sitting there saying the same thing right now. Is like, okay, I'm passionate about this. I want to help, but I don't know what to do. Right. So either I don't have an outlet to do that through my company, and I think the answer and the thing we really want to be able to get across is that there are always ways, right? And that's the piece. And so that's why, again, I mean, I'm really glad that we're bringing this up and bringing to light the fact of how can you start an employee resource group if there isn't one. If you're at a smaller company, how can you create this? And again, more than anything else, how can you make this, to your point of creating those groups, giving them the space and time and effort and potentially money and funding that they need to be successful, but then how does that get woven into the day-to-day workings of the company culture and strategy? Because that's, again, that's the end goal of all of this.
Yeah, if anything stays siloed, then it will not be an effective initiative throughout the rest of the company. This goes for marketing, it goes for sales, and it goes for employee resource groups too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Sophia, as always. And all of the references and research can be found in the show notes. If you want to reach out to us directly about this story or to inquire about sharing your own story, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circonresearch.com.
And again, we want to make our podcast an engaging story for you. So this means we want your feedback. Click the link in our show notes to answer some questions about your listening experience.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circon Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circon Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circonresearch.com.